Are you tired of listening to German language all day long?
Don't you just want to get your news and topics presented in English, even though you live in Germany?
Then here's your solution.
Yeah! Elephant in the Room, an English radio show where we discuss things that people tend to ignore.
Tune in on Color Radio on 99.3 and 98.4. Every second and fourth Monday of the month.
Elephant in the Room, a radio show by the Black Rose Radio Collective from Dresden.
Hate Mondays. Be organized. Stay cool.
Hello and welcome to our today's show. It's of course Monday and we have some guests today and we're going to talk a bit, or actually the next hour, about the Kurdish community here in Germany and maybe also on other places in this world. Maybe let's start with a short introduction. Maybe you can tell us who you are or how you would like to be addressed and what are you doing?
Yeah, hello. Thanks for having us. My name is Julius and I'm from the Initiative für Frieden in Kurdistan, as it's called in Germany, in German or in English, the Initiative for Peace in Kurdistan here in Dresden. We are working mainly in Dresden on the connection between like the German-speaking left and the Kurdish movement that lives here, on a part of the Kurdish movement that lives here. Since, I think, the end of 2019, ever since the Kurdish attacks on Afrin started. I think we're going to talk about what the initiative does and what we are doing a bit more later. But yeah, so far that's me.
Hi, I'm Befin and I'm from the initiative as well. And thank you for having us.
Okay, why we actually invited you was kind of, there was a recent incident and we thought, okay, maybe we should actually talk about it a bit and contextualize. At the 12th of February here in Dresden, the Kurdish activist Talisin he set himself on fire in front of the Saxon Parliament. This is kind of in the city center next to the tourist area. And out of the injuries, he died, unfortunately. And the last place where he was living and where he was also politically active was Dresden. And maybe you can tell us a little bit about him. What was his story?
Maybe I can tell you about the whole incident first and then maybe talk about Khalil a bit more. So basically what had happened was that one day before that happened, on the 11th of February, there was a demonstration in Dresden and Albertplatz against Turkish attacks on the region Gare in southern Kurdistan. And basically right after that, Khalil told people that he was going to visit a demonstration in Berlin over the weekend and left the house on the 12th on Friday. And basically about the whole situation, about somebody lighting themselves on fire, we heard about that from the news and didn't really make the connection to Khalil. But during the weekend, when nobody really heard from him and really had contact to him, people started to suspect that that could have been him. And so we were actually trying to find out. We were contacting the police in Dresden and other authorities, trying to confirm whether that might have been our friend. because people were missing him. He was not, nobody heard from him like for days, and people who actually had a key to his apartment noticed that there was basically nothing missing. His keys were missing and his passport, but he didn't really pack anything. And so, but we were told by the authorities that they didn't really know if he was that person, and that they were trying to find out by checking his DNA, doing a DNA test. And basically, we were kept in the dark about the identity of that person until the 16th, like 4 or 5 days after we contacted them. And on the 16th, they told us that that was, in fact, Halil, and that they identified him by comparing his fingerprints. We later found out that that was a lie, too, because due to the nature of his death, there couldn't have been like fingerprint checks, actually. And also, they actually had his passport and all his personal things, so they must have known that it was him already at the 12th. And we suspected that they tried to keep that a secret so that demonstrations or any kind of like manifestation of people's grief and people's anger could not have taken place on the 15th, because that is the anniversary of the incarceration of Abdullah Öcalan, the leader of the Kurdish Workers' Party. Yeah, and after that, there was a lot of confusion as well. They took forever to actually release his body and make it possible to transfer it to his hometown. Yeah, but we can talk about this a bit later if you want. To Hevar Halil himself, he was in Germany for almost 30 years, I think, like 25 years. He came to Germany in the 90s, in 1996. Before, he lived in a village in the north of Kurdistan, like in the east of Turkey, until 1995, when that village was destroyed by the Turkish army, as were many villages in that area in that time. And lived for about 1 year in exile in Mersin. So he comes from a quite politically active family. Apparently, his brother at the time had already fallen with the guerrilla. And so during the time, there was a lot of repression against him personally and his family. So there was like random searches of their house, random incarcerations and stuff like that. And that was basically apparently the reason for his family to send him to Germany to, yeah, make it possible that he could like live in a more secure environment. So he came to Germany in 1996 and lived in various places. He started in Altenburg, I think, and in Halle, and moved to Germany, to Dresden, I think, at the end of the 90s, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, I think we both have to say that we, I mean, basically everybody who has to do with the the Kurdish community in Dresden, basically knew Halil. I think there were not that many people who actually knew him very close, like personally, because he was like always very warm, very friendly, but not that like easily accessible, I guess.
Yeah, sure. Like, I mean, he was like a staple of the Kurdish community. It was clear that he was always like active on the Kurdish issue, also in the times where you didn't have like this clear structure through the Dernek, which is Dernek is like a term for the Kurdish Verein here, Deutsch-Kurdische Begegnungsverein. Yeah, and I didn't know him closely as well, but I was aware of him, and he was like a clear staple of the community, and for a lot of people it was quite a shocking and quite emotional event, like his act of killing himself through setting himself on fire was something that no one was aware of beforehand. Like, it became clear that he planned it and that he prepared for it, but literally everyone was like quite surprised and shocked by his choice and the event that happened.
Germany right now has one of the biggest Kurdish communities in the world, one of the biggest migrant communities in the world. And Halil case, as you described it, is also an example of how the German state is treating Kurdish community, trying to silence the actions of the people within the community, why they're doing that, preventing people from actually figuring out this kind of events, because this is like a huge socio-political statement, not only for the Kurdish community, but for the whole society. However, the repressions against the Kurdish community didn't start in the last years. It's been happening for, I don't know, for several decades already. And German state is working together with the Turkish state in that case. For me, it's quite interesting if you can give a little bit of an idea of the history of criminalization of the Kurdish diaspora in Germany. Why and how and when did it start? Because there are also a lot of other migrant communities that are present in the country that do not get such a big attention from the German state, all in all.
Yeah, that's quite an on-point question. I'm not the best one for like proper numbers, but in general, the Turkish state and the German state had been working for quite some time, like for a long time. Like, Turkey was like one of the main buyers of German weapons, and they have quite an intimate political relationship with each other. And in the Turkish state, from the beginning of the Turkish state, the Kurdish people have been repressed people and have been like systematically attacked in all kinds of manners. Like, you had like political repressions, you had like the destruction of villages, the killing of civilians, and also guerrillas. And with the founding of the PKK in the 70s, 60s or 70s? 70s. Sorry. After the founding of the PKK in the 70s, like, you had a more homogeneous militant Kurdish movement in Turkey that was quite challenging the Turkish government. And civil war-like state that you had in Turkey, especially like in the east of Turkey, a lot of people fled to Europe, to Germany, to France. And especially in the late 80s, early 90s, like, you had a lot of Kurdish people coming to Germany, and the beginnings of like a big Kurdish society.
Diaspora.
Thank you so much. Diaspora here in Germany. And we saw with Heval Khalil, a lot of people that came here didn't stop being politically active. Quite on the contrary, they continued to be politically active. And from the very beginning, the Turkish state made it clear that the PKK and all associations with it are terrorists, and that they had to be treated like that. And Germany took over that narrative. Or any kind of like Kurdish political activism, and most of it was like peaceful, was treated as like being a preamble to like terrorists starting off their activism here. And so you had like the narrative within the German police also that Kurdish activists had to be approached as like really dangerous individuals. And any kind of like civilian activism that you had in the form of like these dernecks that basically just do like organized protests or organized talks, do peaceful protests, were like seen as an organization of the PKK, and through that seen as a terrorist organization and like oftentimes closed up. Like in Dresden, you already, this is the third Danek that you've got here. It's not the first one. The last one was closed in the early 2000s, I think. Maybe you just want to talk.
Well, I guess the situation of the Kurdish diaspora and the Kurdish movement in Germany is quite quite a unique one for Germany. As Berfin just said, the singular aspect is the whole criminalization of the PKK as a terrorist organization, and which makes basically everything that happens within that Kurdish within the context of the Kurdish movement and the freedom movement surrounding also like the Rojava solidarity work, either it is like treated as like the support of terrorist organizations, or it is at the very least suspicious of being part of a terrorist movement. And that actually gives the German state quite a lot of instruments to criminalize and silence these movements. So, and actually, Heba Halil's story is quite a good example of that. I mean, he's been criminalized in Turkey, but almost immediately after arriving here, he has been subjected to, of course, like qualitatively different, but also like very similar treatment. So he's been incarcerated in Germany for 3.5 years in total. He's been incarcerated the last time, I think, in 2012. And actually the quote-unquote crimes that he's been incarcerated for is also a good example of like the effects that criminalization has. Because he's never been accused of like personally participating in any violence or in like the preparation of, I don't know, terrorist attacks or anything of the kind. What he's been accused of was like distributing newspapers or collecting donations or organizing events like, as we talked about, like peaceful events like demonstrations or book readings and stuff like that. And it's quite a unique situation even for other movements that are confronted with this kind of repression to be actually criminalized for relatively harmless, quote-unquote crimes. I'd say like the most recent form of political violence that the PKK actually gets accused in Germany is quite a bizarre one. It's like the blockades on the autobahn in the early 90s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is something what Germans really heard, that somebody blocked the highways.
Yeah, they hold their autobahn very, very dear. No, but in all seriousness, I mean those demonstrations that actually blocked the highways is like 30 years ago by now. So that is something that is actually quite removed from the movement's actions right now. I think there's actually been like an official apology even by the PKK for doing that. But even that, I mean, let's be real. I mean, we're talking about demonstration that blocked highways, but even that is not like terroristic activities. That is relatively normal, like demonstrational actions in other political contexts. So that is something that is quite unique. And I think the basis of all of that is, rather close diplomatic relationship between the German and the Turkish state. And that has very, very deep historical roots that go even like back even before World War II. They have always been like very close partners. And it's the Turkish state always has made it clear, I think, for the last 20 to 30 years that the criminalization and the repression against the Kurdish movement was always one of their main objectives in the diplomatic contact with European countries. And that is, you can actually see that in the present as well. Whenever there is something that the European Union or Germany want to discuss with the Turkish state, be it like refugee deals or as Berfin said, like weapons dealers or something like that, that is always a time period where the repressions against Kurdish movements and Kurdish organization always ramp up.
I also think that actually the Kurdish people from the Kurdish movement are one of the highest number of political prisoners in Germany, right?
I'm not familiar with the numbers of other communities with that, but it seems plausible. Yeah.
No, I mean in the sense that they are charged under this article of under the terrorist article, which are actually not so many people are facing here in Germany, and not even Nazis, which might be terrorists, but are not charged for that. And who are facing actually a harsh regime in the prison, like total isolation and things like that. So I think the extent the repression has against Kurdish community is incomparable to any other political movement here in Germany.
Yeah, and especially on the topic of incarceration, like that's one of the main issues that like the Kurdish movement here also protests about, like... it has its like focus on Abdullah Öcalan and his like isolated incarceration since the 90s, but like work that the that places like the Deutsch-Kurdischer Begegnungsverein do is like stuff like putting public pressure on those kind of like inhumane incarceration forms, and that's one of the staples of what the Kurdish movement does in Germany and in Europe. And it's like really highly questionable what about that is supposed to be like a terrorist activity and dangerous, and it's just incredibly ridiculous like how much of like a massive force is put massive force and massive pressure is put on them for this kind of political work.
The funny thing is that, well, actually it's not really funny, but the article that you talked about, this terrorism article in the Penal Code in Germany, has like a special form, this article 129B, which is actually the support of a terrorist organization abroad. So the interesting thing about that article is that the state doesn't really have to, or the police doesn't really have to convict you for any terrorist acts that happen here. It has to convict you of supporting terrorist acts that happen in different countries, which is quite a difficult thing to do, and always renders like really bizarre proceedings. But as you said, it's very interesting to see which organizations are actually prosecuted under that paragraph and which ones aren't. And it largely actually follows the terrorism watch list of the European Union that usually is put together by the European Commission. And then there's like a conference, I think, every 6 months where the German Department of the Interior, the Department of the Exterior, and funny enough, the Department of Commerce decide together which organizations are to be prosecuted under that.
And when you've got like something that's like a terrorist watch list, it's or like terrorist activity that's like being decided by a country like Turkey, like what's terrorist activity? Which is fucking ridiculous, because up until the 90s it was forbidden to speak Kurdish in Turkey. Like, you had a massive assimilation politic towards the Kurdish movement. Any kind of like activism was like shut down immediately. And if that kind of country like decides what is terrorist activity that you then get convicted here in Germany for, that's messed up.
Totally. Okay, let's listen to some music and then continue. مام یک نامه بنویسم به معارف و بگم سلام به کارکنان معارف بی فرهنگ استادان جهل و طرفداران جنگ سلام به گوارا که به جای قلم تفنگ میده دست مرد و کنن هر دو پای زن لنگ سلام به قنی یکی از کاکه های شهر که طالب در سن فسی چی نداره خبر سلام به مادرم که حتی بدون هیچ سواد از معارف
داره فیشر میفهمه ارزش اتحاد گوارا ما بیشتر از طالبان میدیم تا پول خاطر پیسه نکن و برابری رقبون دایم ملامت کرده طالبان اشغالگر حال تو نمیخوای پیشرفت خانم دیگر امروز صدای فردا میگی باش گرو کر والا گپ تو مسابیس برم با گوز خر هست میفهمی در برابر جل میشیم پیروز چون راهی آینده هست نه راه دیروز بشین تماشا کن که چطورم جنس من با همه موانع باز میده ادامه یا مورف مورف با جوک میگه مورف ما صدا خوغت نمی کنیم کون لق مخالف مورف مورف با جوک میگه مورف ما صدا خوغت نمی کنیم کون لق مخالف 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 مادرم خورد از طالبان تا پدر کلانش خاطر زن بودن دایم مش بر دهانش تو آرزوی مکتب کرد ناگهانم اگی و فکر فروشش شدن در سن کودکی تا حوث رقصیدن کرد نامیدنش بدنام تا آوازی سرد و جامعه گفتش حرام از او دوزیدن حق شادی و اعترام روی آیش را فروختن در ملای آم آل همو مادر پشت مست مثل یک رفیق ما و برادر من مساوی میکنه تشویق میگه در انتظار ما ساینده مختلف دخترم پیش برو کنه لق مخالف زندگی خودت است زندگی من تسلیم افکار طالبانه نشو بده ادامه معارف میترسه از صدای اعتراض دختر ثابت کن که هستی بلندتر بخون آواز 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 معارف معارف بازجوک میگه معارف ما صدا خوغت نمی کنیم کون لق مخالف معارف معارف بازجوک میگه معارف ما صدا خوغت نمی کنیم کون لق مخالف ما نمیشیم قانه هرچی که مانه سر رای مانه میده میدامه میده میدامه میده میدامه میده میدامه میده
So we're back in the studio in Color Radio, in case you didn't know which radio you are listening, actually. We are having an interview today about the Kurdish community in Germany and having two guests today. I'm not going to do the introduction once again. You have to listen to that online. Anyway, so jumping back to the topic, the Kurdish community has quite a vivid set of topics. I mean, it's talking about repressions, but there are other questions that are raised on a regular basis. Can you describe a little bit what are like the social-political issues that are inside of the community and outside of the community?
Okay. Well, we talked about a bit of that already, I guess. So, as you said, like one big part actually is the whole topic of repression against the community and repression against organizations, because that is quite a central problem, because it makes communication about other topics and other organizations quite difficult. It makes For example, it's difficult to talk about like criticisms and like political discussions within the community and with other political and social movements in a situation where actually a lot of organizations are forbidden and cannot technically exist, and where practically every mention of those, for example, a mention of the PKK, makes you actually suspicious of being a terrorist. Makes the whole discussion and the whole conversation about political issues quite difficult.
Another issue that is constantly raised up is the incarceration of Abdullah Öcalan. He's held in quite high esteem in the Kurdish community. He's one of the leaders of the Kurdish Working Party, and he's the leading philosopher and theorist when it comes like to this democratic confederalist concept that's been like lived out in Rojava. So it's not uncontroversial because he's got like quite like a position as like he's being seen quite a lot as like a leading figure, and obviously you also have like a bit of a glorification with him going on, but he is a central figure when it comes to the Kurdish conflict, and he's been in isolated incarceration since the 90s on an island.
The name is Imre Ali.
Thank you. An island in Turkey. And like the Kurdish movement has, since its incarceration, also constantly had a constantly campaigns going on, fighting against this unhuman situation that he finds himself in. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, these are like two topics that are pretty intertwined because they are both like touching on the whole part of repression. I think what is one of the most interesting political concepts and most of the most interesting concept in this whole fight at all is, as we just touched on, the whole idea of democratic confederalism as a society concept. That is something that is right now put into practice in regions like Rojava, but also in other regions. And I think that is a point that is oftentimes quite lost on other political left-wing movements, because a lot of the solidarity work that is going on in that regard is like focused on the military conflict that is surrounding it and the living conditions of people in that area. But I think it, if you're approaching it like that, you're not really doing the concept justice. Because I think the most interesting aspect of it is, how can this be like an idea that can be an alternative to our way of organizing a society? Like an alternative to what's called like the capitalist modern period.
Yes, and like it's quite important at this point to say that like the Kurdish movement, the Kurdish movement used to have like as a central goal to get a Kurdish national state, but like it's important to see that like there was a paradigm shift. And that the approach to a more free society changed to this like democratic confederalist concept. So after the quite intense political shift within the movement, you saw a more I reckon less authoritarian and less nationally orientated movement and a goal with it. And that's something that has always been a staple of like the Kurdish movement to push that project. And for the past 5 years, we've had a real life example of it.
And I think it's it would be a quite interesting debate to have within the left wing and social movements. How to adapt that concept and what chances and what similarities this concept has to our ideas of social organizing, actually. Because the challenges that people are faced, for example, in the Confederation of Northern and Eastern Syria, which is the official title of the Confederation of Rojava, they are actually faced with quite different challenges, I would argue, than we are here. So their main challenges are like organizing a peaceful coexistence of different like ethnical groups, religious groups, to actually break traditional gender roles is a huge part of the struggle, or like I'd argue like the central part of the struggle. But they don't have like their economical challenges are different than ours, I'd argue. So they're not. This is not as urbanized and as industrialized society as, for example, Central Europe would be. And it's I'd say it's like the most interesting discussion that you can have is how to adapt these concepts of to a very different situation that we have right here.
I was wondering, because you said their Kurdish community is kind of supporting and approaching the whole Rojava project, but how is this? If you see here the community in Dresden, for example, or other communities in Germany, how much are they actually affected by this? How much are they influenced by this kind of development happening there?
Well, I think the Kurdish movement obviously isn't throughoutly homogeneous movement. So you've got quite differences from state to state, from association to association. But you do have umbrella organizations that give a certain structure and that give the possibility for different cities and Kurdish activists in different cities and countries to connect with each other and to work together on the same issues. And you've got obviously also quite tight connections between the Kurdish movement here in Germany and in Europe in general and over there in Turkey and Syria and Iran and Iraq. So, there's a lot of communication going on and a lot of exchange, a lot to learn for us from this kind of lived out international praxis of the theory. And you've got regularly exchanges going on and books being published on by the delegations that get to go over there and experience themselves how this kind of alternative society is being built up and improved upon.
So you do have a real exchange, people from the communities here are going there to kind of see how the things are developing?
Well, as far as that is possible, of course. Sure. I mean, the travel is, sometimes it's more difficult than other times. And a lot of people are actually, for a lot of people, it's quite difficult to, for example, travel to Turkey because of their political status.
Yeah, sure. It's certainly quite a bit of a clandestine thing that's going on there because it's... politically quite difficult with Turkey and the area is one of the issues that the people there are facing is that they are an active war zone. So that's also a completely different challenge that they have to encounter there too.
But in general, you would say that Rojava is the point or is eventually the place where the kind of new thoughts and ideas are created and distributed to other Kurdish communities around the world? Or is this too, I don't know, or is it more...
Well, you want to say something?
I that's an interesting question, but I think it implies that the Kurdish movement would be more centralized than it is. In the early beginnings of the militant Kurdish movement through the PKK, you'd certainly had quite an authoritarian structure and quite tight structure, but that loosened up over time and also you not just because they removed themselves more and more from an authoritarian structure, but also because you had the possibility of first of all Kurdish more homogeneous Kurdish movement opened up the possibility of having more organized Kurdish activism in different areas of the world and also Europe. And I think you've got still some centralized aspects to it, but I would say the input comes from all over.
And also I'd say that, first of all, I mean the challenge and also kind of advantage that Rojava has is the situation that Befin just mentioned, the active war zone situation, because that is on one hand it's super difficult circumstances for a transition in that society organizing, but it also has its chances because where the structure of things imploded, there is kind of a room to reorganize. And that is something that is of course, a bit more difficult for people living in diaspora, because we hear people are living in like quite well-functioning capitalist societies. That is not, might not be the case over there. But and also I'd say that not just is are there differences between like diaspora and Rojava, or Rojava and Bakur, or Rojava and Basur, but I'd say that Rojava itself is not as homogenous as one would think, because the communities might like be very different in certain aspects from town to town, from street to street, from city to city. And that is, I'd say, one of the central strengths, actually, of that society concept.
Talking about homogeneous communities, right? And at the example of Germany, how actually different the political ideas and social ideas within the Kurdish community? Because I think like the average leftist, average anarchist thinks that an average Kurd is the person who has an Abdullah Öcalan on the wall of every room and wears a flag and knows how to dance and has like a whatever bullshit is in the stereotypes of the head. But I think like, as I can imagine, knowing other communities, it is not that simple, the whole political ideas. And for me, it would be also interesting to hear what are those political ideas apart from this like a dominating narrative that is trying to be brought by the leftists to the leftist community. At the end of the day, do you have like a crazy Kurds who just don't like anything and they're just anarcho-individualists and they hate society, or like a little bit more complicated things?
I'd say even the concept of an average average anarchist is quite a weird concept, I'd say.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, I think like I literally don't know anyone in my age that actually has a Öcalan poster hanging in their room. But I have to say I'm quite young in comparison. But like if I would look at like the generation of my parents, like the way older people, I feel like there's a generational difference, that they're a bit more authoritarian-orientated, or that they... I don't want to badmouth anyone, but, like, you did have a paradigm shift. Like, you used to have a long time, like, the understanding that, like, to gain freedom, to have the freedom of speaking Kurdish and to walk the streets and see your ethnicity as something, or your cultural heritage, however you want to define that. I don't want to open up that kind of hornet's nest. But, like, however you define, like, basic human rights to be able to speak a language and to dance to certain music, that should be possible without, like, being shut down by the police or fellow citizens. So this goal of, like, creating a space where you could live as a Kurdish person without being persecuted used to be seen in the form of a national state, and that changed that kind of goal. But you certainly in the Kurdish movement still have people who approach the issue of like revolution or like the revolutionary change of society through a more conservative, like not conservative, more reformist lens. You've got people who see it more through a not through the lens of like, oh yeah, we can change it through the state, but we need a militant approach. You've got people who are like, no, we need a revolution. And you can find all kinds of like, all kinds of people. What you can certainly like say is that like in general, you do have a lot of people who like really appreciate Öcalan, because like he is a founding, like basically the founding father for like a lot of like the theories that lead to the concept that is being trying to live out in Rojava. So, but you've also got this controversial issue of him being hyped up to a really strongly glorified leader figure. So you've got like controversial issues within the Kurdish movement. Yeah, maybe you want to like say something about that.
Well, first of all, from a legal standpoint, of course, nobody has an Öcalan portrait at their wall, because that would be illegal.
in Germany. No,
it's actually, it's actually kind of a kind of an interesting aspect on the whole repression front again.
Mm-hmm. Holy shit, I forgot about that.
Yeah, that is. No, oh but God. It's like super bizarre. Like, I'm not aware of any political figure outside of that one Hitler portrait where you actually cannot show that portrait. That is quite rare. But on a more serious note, I would say that one has to take into consideration that this whole shift of paradigm from like this originally like really strongly centralized, more or less like Leninist kind of way to organize to this concept of democratic confederalism that is largely based on the theories of Mori Bookchin. That is a transition that actually happens right now. So we're talking about like a time frame of 15, maybe 20 years within a movement that is like almost 50 years old. And that is something that, as you just said, right, it's like a generational thing, is my understanding, actually, that people all, who actually grew up in a different time, in a different paradigm, sometimes have a difficult time to adapt to that, to a different idea. And sometimes I think those things take a bit more time within the diaspora because you're not really like you are surrounded by these ideas, but they're not like your personal day-to-day life actually. And actually, also there, Heva Halil is quite a good example because the way of ending his life and this whole action of setting himself on fire is actually something that used to be, a form of action that was taken quite, I wouldn't say often, but it was kind of common. And then was something that was like, that the movement kind of distanced themselves from. So that is something that is widely criticized and the movement usually, says that they don't want people to do that. But then again, as you can see, there are still people practicing this.
Yeah. I would suggest a song and then. Let's get into the last round.
Еще одну причину для успокоения. Еще одна причина, чтобы верить. И жать вам, друзья, всем вам руки искренне и смело. Находить в каждом из вас спасение. И в глаза смотреть, забыв простертые в кровь колени. Знать, что завтра будет счастливое утро. Это время наступит. Пусть жутко воет ветер на улице и внутри где-то. Мы жить будем, еще как будем. И наша песня не спета. Я к вам подойду ближе, чтобы дыхание услышать. Шепну на ухо, будем радоваться. Ведь уже без шансов. Отбросы безумцы, буду вам улыбаться. Буду шагать с вами рядом, усталая, рычать свою правду. Мне ответит молчание многоэтажки, садики, столбы фонарные. А я им будем радоваться, ведь уже без шансов. Мне ответит молчание многоэтажки, садики, столбы фонарные. А я им будем радоваться, ведь уже без шансов. Не забудь посмотреть мне в глаза, ведь там есть кое-что для тебя. И ты забирай это вечное слово, действуй. Не забудь посмотреть мне вслед, подмигнув хитрым глазом, как в детстве. Воплотить в жизнь так громкое слово вместе. У отвергнутых иные цели, чем лежа в постели, думать о воскресенье. У отвергнутых иные цели, чем зарабатывать на коктейли, и съев на завтрак свои мечты, утопать в понедельниках. Схвати меня сильнее под локоть, не отпускай, отпусти свою робость. Бежать, спасаясь, ведя по самому краю этого сплошного безумия ада. Когда смысла нет показаться умным и одиноким волком без толку. Здесь все просто, старое неинтересное вместе. Старое доброе действовать, старое неинтересное вместе. Старое доброе действовать. Пусти меня сильнее за плечи, не отпускай, отпусти вечный холод и ветер. Поплетемся с тобой по дорогам отбросов, по вытоптанному, непостроенному уйдем вдаль. И найдем однажды, найдем ту самую свободную магистраль. Не смотри, что устал, не смотри, что один. Огляни, чтобы за блоками стены колючих оград. Однажды увидит сумел блеск чьих-то глаз. Однажды увидит сумел блеск чьих-то глаз. Не забудь посмотреть мне в глаза, ведь там есть кое-что для тебя. И ты забирай это вечное слово, действуй. Не забудь посмотреть мне вслед, подмигнув хитрым глазом, как в детстве, воплотить в жизнь это громкое слово вместе. У отвергнутых иные цели, чем лежа в постели, думать о воскресенье.
Okay, today by Elephant in the Room here on Color Radio, we were talking about the Kurdish movement here in Germany and abroad. And we were talking about Öcalan. Yeah, surprise. And no, but I was wondering actually. And
portraits of Öcalan.
Portraits of Öcalan, who nobody has because they're illegal in Germany.
Of course.
but what I was wondering about is, I was talking with a friend the other day about this question, because from one hand, the central kind of idea of the paradigm change is the liberation of women. And on the other hand, also a lot of women, but I read a lot of interviews from women also from Rojava who were in the mountains, who are fighting and all this, they're all referring to him. And I wonder why a society who wants to be so progressive is not giving more space actually to other women, because there are a lot of women all around the world in the Kurdish community who were speaking up in the last years and who are giving awesome speeches and who have a lot of ideas and knowledge. And I don't know why. Also here, actually, this, it's always pushed on, there's a new book of Öcalan. And you think, okay, there's a new book of Öcalan. But maybe can there not be published something else? Can there not some women be heard and some other things be published?
You're completely right. Yeah, I mean, like, it's a bit more complex than that, but like, it's mainly, you're right, and I completely agree with you that like that there are so many female, so many women out there, so many Flinters out there who were either fight themselves physically as a guerrilla in this war, on this issue, and you've got a lot of people, like a lot of women who write really intelligent, important, and useful stuff on this. Wow, that was horrendous. Sorry. So you've got a lot of women who are active in the Kurdish movement, like who give workshops and who go on delegation journeys and collect the stories of Kurdish women in Rojava and other places, and who try to like push the perspective of Kurdish women and in general the perspective of women and the attempt, like not the attempt, but like the liberation of women in general, because and that they are not like as present to the outside of the movement and also in the inside of the movement. It's quite like they dropped the ball there, but they're working on it. I know a lot of like women who work whose activism is around like it's not solely on the Kurdish issue, but like work a lot on that issue, and they're like I'm a woman too. We are a staple of this movement. Like, we're really important to this movement and we should be pushed more on the forefront. And I would certainly say that in the past couple of years, you've seen that, like, more women have been pushed to the forefront of this whole thing. Like, I mean, like, but it has to become more visible. But the thing is, it has become a bit more visible, but, like, Öcalan has always dominated the visibility of the Kurdish movement. It's like, I don't understand it myself. I'm always quite like confused by it too, why it's always him that's so central to it. Like, I understand that like his theories that he, the theories are from Bookchin that he improved upon and expounded upon were like really quite important and that he played a central role, but I myself also don't understand why he became the spearhead and the leader of this whole thing.
We had the theory that, or I don't know, we were just thinking that might be one reason is that you have such a traditional and authoritarian kind of communities, like in controlling family and all those kind of issues. And maybe it needs a man out of the community to push the topic more. And that's why he is needed. I don't know, to at least, present this idea to all the male part of the community. It was just an idea that this could be maybe a small point on that, but it's not to justify, just more that we were wondering about it. Yeah.
that might have been a point, I'd say. But then again, I would say that within the organizations that I can attest to, I would say that they are pretty consequential when it comes to this whole principle of always being represented by at least one woman. And this, I don't know the English term for the parités principle.
Just parity principle or something. Yeah, like
probably.
You always have a woman and a man. Yeah. It's just single one woman and like the rest are guys.
Yeah. No, that's what I've... Yeah, I mean, in like... No, but there are positions where there are actually like two women representing the same.
Oh, okay.
So you have like the... You usually have in all organizations, you have one all-gender organization and a women's organization. And actually the one exception to that rule in terms of positions would be Öcalan, actually. And... I think that's a valid criticism, and I think that is your point might be an interesting thought. But even then, I would say that is something that would be like one would wish to overcome that, right? And but on the other hand, too, I mean, there are people who are, for example, Sakine Janzis published a very interesting book on her political fight and stuff like that. They're not as visible, I would grant you that. I'd say that maybe it's also kind of connected to the fight for his freedom and his incarceration, that he's, like, as a prisoner, is pretty visible. But outside of that, I'd say that's a valid point. And, yeah.
Okay, we don't have so much time left.
Oh, yeah. Well,
it's already only 3 minutes, actually.
One song.
Yeah.
For me, what would be interesting is, at the end of the story, is what are the resources where people can find updates on the current struggles that are happening in Germany, but also happening in Europe and maybe somewhere outside?
Oh, that's quite a good question. Like, there are a couple of news websites, news shows, and, like, magazines. Like, is it called Kurdistan Report, okay? Right. Yeah, there's, like, this German magazine, German language magazine, Kurdistan Report, that comes out every 2 months or 3 months. We can get updates. Then you've got the websites ANF News, then also we as an initiative obviously have a website. It's
Well, the exact name of the websites we can also publish on our website.
Okay, sweet. So you've got the ANF News, which is like in German, English, Kurdish, and a couple of other languages that I don't recognize. what else?
Yeah, we're trying to over our website actually try to keep people informed on what's happening in Dresden, Leipzig, and Chemnitz, actually. For example, right now we're in a big fight with the city over our exclusion from the International Weeks Against Racism because of being accused of being a PKK under-organization.
Sure.
Yeah, usual shit. So we have an open letter right now that we sent to them. So that would be something quite, quite recent.
Yes. I'm sorry, I can't think of any news websites apart from ANF right now, but there are a couple more out there, but that's the one I can think of in different languages. The Kurzen Report, and there are obviously like a shit ton of books out there by Öcalan and other people. a couple months ago, a new book came out.
Wir wissen, was wir wollen.
Wir wissen, was wir wollen, Teil 2. It's from a delegation. Like, a delegation went to northern and east Syria, so to Rojava, and, like, captured the perspective of women who are, like, working for the freedom. Fighting for the freedom.
Okay. Thanks a lot for this talk today.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
I think there's a lot more to talk about, but we just have this 1 hour.
The mustache of Öcalan.
The mustache?
It's a separate topic.
Can I have like one serious point? Every first Thursday of the month, we have like an open meeting, which is advertised on our website.
Okay, good. So if you want to join here locally, then every month,
first
every first
Thursday.
Every Thursday and once. Okay, this was Elephant in the Room for today. You can listen to our show on Channel Zero Network on Free Radio here in Germany. We will see each other. We will listen to each other. You will listen to us in 2 weeks.
Yeah, and
stay cool. Stay cool. Hate Mondays and be organized. Ciao.
Ciao. Ciao.
Bye.